Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Welcome, everyone. If you're just joining us this morning, we have a great show lineup today. Unfortunately, our first guest could not be with us today, but you're in luck because we're going to play one of our favorites, which is the Exit Coach highlights, all-star highlights. And these are snippets, brief excerpts from interviews with 10 of our prior guests on a wide variety of topics. So here we go with the all-star number 8, and we'll be back with you in a few minutes with our first guest.
And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
When your business value is wrapped up in your client list, what's the most important thing you can do to drive the value of your business? We asked expert Stacy McKibben.
If you don't have really strong, you know, client relation management tools, CRMs as they're lovingly referred to, if you don't have tools like that in your business, it's going to be very difficult to transition it over. As a matter of fact, your next buyer is going to use that as a reason to drive down your sale price. Absolutely, one of the biggest areas of opportunity that we see in professional services businesses are going back to your existing and previous clients. Oftentimes we just forget that they don't necessarily know the full breadth of services that we provide and how they can use us or even refer us to their friends and family. So that is a big win in most businesses, is just starting there. And it's very difficult to do if you don't have a good system in place with which to do it.
One of the most common ways a business is sold is through something called an earnout. And we asked for information and an example from business broker Chris Bond.
What buyers want to have happen is they want a seller to prove the actual value of the business by having them be patient and waiting for a piece of the payout. So in other words, once the transition period has happened, say 6, 12, 18, or 24 months, the buyer will make additional payments with the comfort that, okay, it is what you said it is. Had a very creative deal earlier this year where down payment was made for about 80% of the deal. A bank stepped in for a percentage of the deal. The seller actually financed another small percentage of the deal. And the earnout comes in years 3, 4, and 5. So everybody's pulling in the same direction, making sure the first 2 years go very smoothly.
What are some of the challenges for leaders in this knowledge-based economy? Here's CEO Coach Bill Anton.
The person that has the most influence over the entire organization is the person that leads the organization. And transforming that person exponentially influences change. My training as a psychologist, my understanding about the kinds of organizations that are going to be successful in the future are going to be organizations that realize that knowledge is their product and that knowledge can only be created by enrollment, not by compliance. And so the task of the leader of the future is to transform the people that work in the organization so that they want to give their best and so that they're willing to offer ideas and perspectives that create knowledge and innovation for the organization.
Medical insurance is a big part of your budget. How do you contain those costs? We ask benefits expert Rhett Bray.
We'll talk about wellness as how we can start to communicate the importance of the wellness and that we give the people and the employees the opportunities to do things that will help them to become healthier. We start to educate them on the importance of annual physicals. We start to educate them on preventative care. Women do this quite well. Men have a tendency to wait till body parts don't work and then they go, which can be late. And it's interesting. We take better care of our car. We change the oil. We see the light, the lamp light comes on, and for a lot of us, we don't do the maintenance that we should do on a regular basis. That will identify a lot of issues that people have that now you can start to address, either through medication, through exercise or diet. There are just a few key areas that you can identify that will drive these higher costs.
Okay, so we've heard the term before, treat your business like an investment. It'll be a lot easier to sell down the road. What exactly does that mean? We asked an expert, Don Berzin.
Many of us in the field, encourage owners to look at their business as an investment. Some owners understand that concept, but many do not. I mean, for a number of them, they see their business as either a job, a cash machine, a passion, or an extension of who they are. And the term investment sounds a little too removed for them to relate to. And we also let it be known that a business is actually easier to sell when it has a passive ownership. I mean, an owner who is not personally critical to maintaining future cash flows. But let's face it, I mean, one of the last terms that ever come to mind when we think about most entrepreneurs is passive. You know, these people are doers, they make things happen, and sitting on the sidelines is not something that many of them want to do at any stage of their career.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Why would you have a revocable living trust instead of a will? Here's attorney Matt Amaro.
One of the main reasons that you would consider doing a revocable trust versus just having a will is avoiding what we would call a probate process, which is a court proceeding to distribute a family estate, which can be very expensive and legal fees, court fees, and just involves a lot of court involvement that can be pretty painful. So by using a trust, you can get out of that. Now, if your assets aren't high enough, that's one way you may be able to avoid probate without a trust. And the other way is you may have assets that are able to pass to beneficiaries outside of a trust and outside of probate, even if you don't have a trust. But when you have real property, you usually won't be able to avail yourself of those two exceptions to staying out of probate.
How do most people decide it's time to start exit planning, and what's on their mind when they do? Here's Jim Immel.
Long term is really interesting. I use the analogy of the light switch. Sometimes these business owners don't think about it, and then all of a sudden they wake up one day and they just want to turn the light switch off, and they go from being passionate 100% into the game, and then all of a sudden something starts feeling heavy. Maybe it's a personal situation that's happened, but they literally turn the light switch off. Most of the people that you and I work with, it's more like a dimmer switch. They just don't do it that quick. They do it over time. But what really a lot of them are thinking about is, how do I transition myself out of the leadership position, provide other people opportunity to get into that leadership position, so the business is being prepared to transition from a position of strength and not weakness.
People are nervous about stocks and bonds these days. What's the outlook for income real estate? We asked real estate expert Scott Tamkin.
I'm a firm believer that income property will grow wealth over time. And there are parts of Los Angeles where income property is still affordable. The west side of L.A. doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but there are parts of L.A. where there are still opportunities. And I firmly believe that, particularly in some of the outlying areas, the gentrification will continue and people will want to rent in those areas, particularly as public transportation expands. People have some extra money. They're looking to invest in income property. I would say good strategy might be to join up with others who are doing the same. There are some crowdfunding sites that offer some opportunities to do that, but I would be careful just jumping in and talk to an expert in the multifamily business. I think over time it will prove to be lucrative.
Protecting your assets is important, but when you do, it is even more important. Here's attorney Harry Barth.
A very important component to understand is that, as with all business deals, asset protection being just one of them, is to be able to settle a proposed claim within reasonable limits. It's very, very difficult to do that if you are in jeopardy of losing your home, losing your business, and losing your life savings. So I think that it's important that asset protection is granular. We look at the various components. We take into consideration all of the goals and objectives of our particular clients. And there's not one size fits all. Every situation is different. Every background is different. Every family makeup is different. Every business transaction is different.
What's the best way to use Twitter and other social media? We asked expert Tim Templeton.
I just had a friend ask me today, I don't really get Twitter. What is the value? And I said, you know, it's two things. It's self-promotion, or business promotion in this case, and it's research. So So if you want people to know who you are and what you're doing, and you create content, you create blog content, you want people to see it, one of the best ways to get it out in front of people is to send out an announcement using Twitter. Likewise, if you're trying to find people in your ecosystem, your business, the analysts, the resellers, the potential partners, you can find them by their activity on Twitter. You can interact with them. You can follow them. You can retweet things that they're sending. And you can create a relationship that way, which is a lot easier than it used to be.
And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
What are some of the factors that go into evaluating a business at any given time? We asked valuation expert Christopher Mercer.
It's one thing to say that your value is worth what a willing buyer and a willing seller will pay. But that same willing buyer and same willing seller won't pay the same thing in 2008 as they will in 2014, because in 2008 the world was full of uncertainty that caused financing to dry up, and it was enormously difficult to sell. Some of your listeners that are listening to this need to think about the fact that they need to be thinking of an orderly transition of management and ownership, because when bad things happen to your company, you lose all flexibility in terms of ownership and management transition. So take care of those things now while you can.
Being in business is inherently risky. We all know that. But what are some of the most common mistakes that business owners make and their potential solutions? We asked for comments from attorney Mayar Ghassemian.
One of the important mistakes is not having a corporation or LLC or another form of entity that would limit their liability in case they get sued. I have seen a lot of companies that do this, and it's very prevalent in the construction industry. If they're around for a while and they don't have an entity, they are going to be sued sometimes, especially in construction. And what happens is, and they put their own personal properties in danger because they don't have an entity that would protect them.
What are some of the important factors that go into a professional business valuation? We asked expert Roger Winsby.
Valuation is really about a sense of future opportunities offset by the risks. And if you don't really think those through as it relates to each individual company, you won't really understand whether you might be above average on that multiple or below average. But it's going to be quite rare when you're right on the average or the median. It's quite an issue that comes up in terms of understanding, you know, the business and being able to document your findings. Valuation is really about future. And as much as, you know, people want to say, well, you know, here are my retained earnings and here's what I've done, and that's, you know, very important context. But ultimately, if someone wants to buy the business, they're buying the future opportunity and weighing that against the future risks.
You know, a lot of business owners I talk to have an image in their mind of how they're going to put up a for sale sign and sell their business quickly and easily, get a big check and invest it. Here's a message from someone who's done it, Veronica Saldivar.
A lot of folks just think, I'm going to sell for X amount of dollars. And, you know, especially here for us in California and other similar states, taxes are a huge, huge consideration. It takes a big bite at your bottom line. I think also one of the other things is to consult with a CPA on that tax liability. When I was negotiating the sale of my business and negotiating the purchase and sale agreement, I also met several times with a tax attorney as well. He helped me draft the documents to prepare to make sure that I was going to fall under cap gains tax treatment, which was huge.
When you're undertaking a big project like exit planning, it's important to know that your advisors are using a specific process. Here's Leo Klein.
Our approach is to say, well, let's have initially that conversation. Let's do some initial fact-finding on everything that is in, you know, that it needs to be looked at to develop that strategy. And once we sort of have developed the strategy, what we do is present that strategy in sort of in a team meeting to all the other advisors, and if needed, we bring in some new advisors if there are certain gaps. Here's the strategy, here are the facts. Let's discuss this and provide your input and suggestions. Let's refine the strategy based on your expertise and then let's finalize it and then implement it. And then from my perspective, best practice is that sort of you repeat this process once a year until you conduct your exit.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
If you're going to grow your business, you've got to grow your sales. Here's Brad Leggett.
One of the key things we work with is performance management. How do you set targets? How do you get a sales team to perform? Because in about roughly half the companies we go into, there aren't formal sales targets in place. And that can be very demotivational to a sales team because they don't know where they're expected to perform to. You often have a very frustrated CEO or head of sales that says, well, the team's not doing well, but they haven't articulated what that target is. And our approach is you work with the sales team to set targets. I mean, the first piece of advice I've got is get a sales target that's written down and put it in front of everybody. That's step one.
Okay.
At least have that. But it's much better to set targets with the sales team's involvement. So sit down, and you don't want to walk into this meeting with a salesperson without some idea of the sales target. You'll have an idea of where it should be. Let's talk about where we think we can get to this year and what our target is.
What are some of the key things that a buyer looks for when they're buying a business? We asked a gentleman who's bought a lot of businesses, Ace Chapman, for his ideas.
The two things that we focus on when either we buy a business outright or we go in and invest in a business is we want the operations really to kind of be everything to be there. What we add on top of that is two things. Most people have not spent a lot of time investing or building out their marketing funnel. And the second part of that is having almost like a franchise-like operations manual that allows the person to come in and feel really comfortable that they're going to be able to run the business and take over from where you are. You want to stand out and have those kind of extras that just make it an easy investment for the buyer.
Technology is here to stay, and having a technology plan is becoming very important. Here's expert Jim Blue.
And a lot of people have a business plan, but they don't have a technology plan. What type of equipment do I need? What type of services that I need? A large percentage of my time is helping people brush up on basic computer skills. I help them select the right equipment, programs, and services, really based on their individual needs. And anytime something new comes out, I'm getting phone calls and emails in terms of whether they should upgrade, whether they should get a new product. You know, the name of the game now is setting up a home office. Most people have some type of technology in their home. There's a big difference between using it for personal use and for using it for business use. And I have to really separate that based on how much time someone's going to be spending in their office and what they do for a living.
What are some of the trends because of the global economy? We asked international law expert Kenneth August.
You mentioned manufacturing. That's a perfect example of where the thinking today is very different from where it was even 5 years ago. And by that I mean traditionally a company might look at outsourcing their manufacturing, let's say to China as an example, in order to lower their cost of production.
Mm-hmm.
But really with the consumer markets moving into those countries where they were outsourcing, it makes a lot more sense today to look not at a unilateral outsourcing manufacturing play, but how can you develop a revenue base and profitability in that local market? And maybe instead of doing all your outsourcing in China, you also have manufacturing in Eastern Europe or in Latin America, and they become concentric circles of new markets that you can sell your products and services into.
Most people think of planning for their death when they visit with an estate planning attorney, but here's another viewpoint from estate planning attorney Michael Wittick.
I tell people all the time, you know, you probably came to me to plan for your death when the baby boomer's biggest problem, I think, is disability. In fact, there are things worse than death, and some types of disability fall into that category. They've already done a study in 2014 and determined that in California, the average cost of long-term care is now $94,000. I would say in almost every case, I recommend that people go get a long-term care insurance consultation just so that they can find out, because that's one of the things that is rapidly changing right now to take care of this increased cost. They are repackaging it, and there are new companies in and some older companies that used to offer it are now out of California. Things are changing in that field just like many others.
You're listening to ExitCoachRadio.com, the show for age 50-plus business owners. We're interviewing professional advisors for their tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new 20-minute interviews and 1-minute highlights every day at ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our 1-minute Exit Coach Tip of the Day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. I'm very pleased to introduce my next guest. He is George Smart, and George is joining us from Strategic Development, Inc. in Durham, North Carolina. And we're going to talk about a subject that's very near and dear to our hearts here at Exit Coach Radio, and that is unraveling family knots. You know, we talk about family businesses a lot, and the real goal of family business planning is to have happy Thanksgivings forever. George is going to help us to talk about that and preparing future roles in family businesses. So, George, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it.
George, how's everything going today? You doing well?
Yes, I'm really glad to be on the show. I think this is an area that a lot of people are experiencing now. The baby boomer demographic is getting to that age where they're thinking about the next stage of their lives.
Absolutely right. Yeah, it's a big push. The statistics are over 77 million baby boomers, but there's over 12 million business owners between baby boomers and traditionalists above, you know, older than them. And yeah, they're all getting to that point, huh, where they're starting to say, maybe it's time to pass the baton a little, or at least start to think about that. So tell us a little bit about you and your background and what you do at MG Partner.
So at Strategic Development, I work as a strategic planning expert with family-owned businesses and other companies, helping them get from one phase of their growth to another. And a very common thing that comes up is a successful family business probably has been around 20 to 30 years and is trying to figure out where the next 20 to 30 years are going to come from. It starts at that Thanksgiving dinner table. And people use that model as a way of trying to guide their strategy for the transition conversation. And it does not work well at all.
Why does it work? Why does it not work?
Well, the thing with most families, and especially in the South where I'm from, is that nobody wants to make anybody else uncomfortable. And everybody wants to be treated fairly and to treat other people fairly. So if you make those two ground rules the basis for any adult discussion, you've pretty much limited any reasonable course of action that could take place. You have to be willing to be uncomfortable to have the discussions about possible futures. Otherwise, you're going to default to what is the least resistant path. And that usually means a bad thing for the business. It usually means putting the business in the hands of somebody who is not the right person. Now, this is complicated by the fact that in most family businesses, because they start out small, one or two people, and can be very large by the time they're through, often in the range of between about 100 and 200 people, folks want to have others like them. They don't want to rock the boat. If there's family members involved, they want to overlook certain deficiencies they may have as managers because they're my son or my daughter or my nephew. And the biggest mistake that people make is they try to adjust the roles to fit the people that they have. Rather than what professionals do in corporations is adjust the people to fit the roles they have.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. You've got some problematic situations where you have other relationships that extend beyond the business. And in a lot of cases, it affects more than the people that are working in the business. There's also issues with people or children working outside of the business as well, and they may have jealousy, or they may have they may wonder how they're going to make out in this kind of a situation. So you have your hands full with a lot of different issues, huh?
Yeah, you do, and that's why most families find it initially uncomfortable, but later incredibly beneficial to bring in a third party who doesn't have the history with the family and doesn't have some of the baggage, to be honest, that the family has about having certain conversations. It's very tough for families to have certain conversations. We all know this from our Thanksgiving dinners. I mean,
absolutely.
Nobody wants to talk about the uncle who's getting drunk in the corner. You know, that's just right. Something that uncle does every year. So in family businesses, we don't want to talk about the fact that one person says they want to work in the company forever but doesn't act like it. We don't want to call them out on that. We don't want to break away from this fairness doctrine. For example, in some companies, you might have three siblings working together, all getting the same pay because nobody wants to be unfair to them. And yet the jobs they're doing are markedly different and carry greatly differing responsibilities. So their pay is not matching their responsibilities. We would never do that with a regular employee, but it happens with companies all the time.
Absolutely right. Yeah, so overall, you'd think that it would be really easy to pass a business to a son or a daughter. There's no interview. You know, it's a simple transaction. But again, as you're pointing out, it's not that easy. And I think you've given us some good reasons. What are some of the ways that the first steps to make this easier and clear away some of the strong emotions that people have about their children and vice versa?
Well, one thing is for the parents to understand that to make a decision really requires that some people get treated better than others. But that's okay if what they're getting is appropriately level to what's going on. So for instance, if you're going to reduce somebody's salary in a company because they're not really responsible for much, that's okay because their responsibilities match their pay. However, you'd be amazed how many companies can't even consider this because that's my daughter Helen, and I don't want to treat Helen any differently than I do Brian, who may be running the whole Western division of the company. Or vice versa. I mean, the point is that you have to start looking at this not in terms of fair or unfair, but in terms of appropriate to the future or not. You would never put an employee in place that didn't have the criteria and the experience and the background to be able to fully do the job, and that's what a lot of companies do with family. One of the things that can be done to prepare family for that is to fire the family member, which can be one of the best things you can do for them. This doesn't have to be a permanent firing. It can be a firing like for 2 years. I have helped clients do this, and it's always very tough in the beginning, but the idea is, let's say that you have a son that is doing okay in your company, but they're certainly not capable of taking it over, and you want to exit the company in 5 years. Well, you can do a couple different things. A, you can do nothing and just make hope your business plan, which I don't advise. B, you can try to give that person some training. You can send them to a few classes. You can maybe send them to a course at a university, and maybe not, they'll learn something, and then you'll sort of see how it goes. A better alternative is to find someone in your industry. So let's say that you're a custom shoe distributor in Michigan. You find one of your buddies or industry pals in California who is running their company that doesn't really compete with you, and see if you can place your son in their company. It's like giving them an internship. And they go to a different company where they're not the family and they don't get the same access and privilege. And they either prove themselves or they don't. So at the end of their time at that other company, that person, that child, either realizes that they don't have what it takes to fully run a company, or that they do, and now they are seasoned and prepared to come back and take over the reins.
I like that. So you're basically hopefully finding something within your industry, so they're learning something about your industry, but they're also learning discipline, and they're learning what it takes from without favoritism to be part of a growing
yes.
And man, well, they'll probably in that 2 years they may not work themselves up to management, of course, but at least you'll have a good a clearer picture of how valuable they are, and they'll have a better understanding of what they have to do without favoritism.
Yeah. And what parents often forget is that while there certainly is greed among children, most of the emotions that children feel is obligation. They don't want to disappoint their parents. They don't want to be the one that says, no, Dad, no, Mom, I'm not going to be part of this business. I want to be an architect. I want to be an engineer. I want to be making movies or doing art. I don't want to work in the business that I've grown up in just because it's not my thing. Children don't really want to say that or find it uncomfortable to say that. So as part of the facilitated process of getting families to communicate with each other, it's related to general family counseling and giving people some ways they can express themselves in a safe manner.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people have dealt with that, George, over the years, as I'm sure you have many times, the fair versus equal treatment. They feel like they want to, you know, there's nothing worse than going into a situation and finding out that there's three children, two of them don't work in the business, one of them does, and Dad has willed the business to all three children equally because they figure they're all my children, I love them all the same. But that's not
right.
The best, that's just not fair for anybody, is it? There's conflicts all around.
Well, it's not fair unless the three children are really equally participating and equally invested in the company. There need to be some predetermined exit strategies for the children. So, for instance, there needs to be options for non-managerial children, non-employee children, to be bought out at the option of the ones that are still in the company. And this is easy to arrange if the parents are still alive. It usually becomes a lawsuit if the parents have passed away.
Good point. Now, George, let me ask you a question, because I see a lot of situations out there where the owner's children aren't quite old enough to – the jury's still out, but they still want to have a plan in place. If, for instance, Dad passes away, they don't want to close the door on the child ever running the business, but they really need that key employee to continue running it. What are some ideas or tips you can give people with situations like that where – The jury's still out as to whether the child will be a potential owner of the business if anything happens or down the road, but yet they have that key employee who needs to be locked in?
Well, I try to get the parents, the owners, to think of a non-family employee they've had that they've really loved. And they think about it a minute, and they usually come up with somebody. Let's call her Julie. So Julie comes to the company when she's 24 years old, and everybody loves Julie, and she does a great job, and she's very dedicated, and she advances a little bit in the company, and Julie gets married and has a family, and everybody loves Julie's husband and her kids. I mean, you've seen this thing before, Bill.
Yeah, sure.
And eventually, everybody loves Julie, but they recognize she doesn't quite have what it takes to really become, say, a vice president. So I'll ask the parents, okay, what's the difference between a situation where we're talking about Julie and a situation where we're talking about your real daughter?
Mm-hmm.
And then they start to get into it. And they start to talk about why they would give their daughter special treatment, when really the things they would do for Julie is what they should do for the daughter. So, for instance, there needs to be a succession plan in place to where if something does happen to the owners, it's identified in advance who would take over and for how long and what sort of succession plan would be followed. Most small companies don't have this. It's just
right.
assumed that Ben, who has been there for 10 years and is the chief financial officer, is going to run things if something goes wrong. But that's usually never written down and certainly never discussed, because people don't want to talk about their own death and they don't want to talk about somebody else passing away. It seems very morbid. But it's one of those necessary, uncomfortable discussions that has to take place. Again, why it's usually better to have a third party there.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
And then the next piece of it is, okay, well, what do we do with Julie or a daughter in terms of advancing them up when they're not ready? Well, you would look at the same things that you would do with an employee when they were not ready. You would look at, is this a person that needs skills? Is this a person that needs education? Is this a person that really needs to leave the company for a certain amount of time and work somewhere else, like we mentioned earlier? That can be an opportunity for that employee just as well as someone in the family. And in fact, certain industries kind of thrive on that informally. They are such that certain types of companies will kind of steal from each other. And so it's become standard practice that, you know, once somebody reaches the VP level, they're probably going to get poached for a couple of years. They go away, they learn a lot, and then maybe they get recruited back to become president of the company later. On a smaller scale, that can be done for most anybody in the company. If it's an important enough position, it's something that should be considered.
Really good points, and I think it also boils down to making sure that there are options available, because the situation might be such that if the business has to be sold to the key employee, because the wife doesn't, for instance, a husband died, the wife doesn't want to be at risk anymore in this business. The key employee wants to buy it, but the son is too young to really get in and manage it. You have to think about what's best for the wife at this point, what's best for her situation. You don't want to offer the employee 20% ownership and then they walk. You don't want an employee to walk away at that
right.
point. There's very delicate issues, and there's a lot of ways to go, and it's important to give the spouse at that point options as much as possible. And so what are some of the components, the components you always look for in a succession plan?
So the first thing to look at is, what are the roles that we're going to need this year, next year, the year after, the year after? And by roles, I mean, what are the positions in the company that we can see we have to fulfill? We're not saying at this point who fills them. We're just saying what the roles are.
Mm-hmm.
That by itself is like throws organizations light years ahead, because they don't often talk about it that way. They talk about Julie, and what are we going to do with Julie? And what are we going to do with our son? They try to fit the people to the roles instead of the roles to the people. And one of the things that really becomes important is laying out these roles over time and saying, okay, we're growing in this market. We're going to need to add 2 salespeople there in about 2 years. And we're decreasing over here, and we can see that role going away. And then once that's all laid out, you can see what the baseline trajectory is for the company given everything else is equal, which, of course, it always isn't. But that's a starting point.
That is
incredibly... And the next thing is to do some scenario planning.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Some scenario planning, which is to say, okay, given our baseline of roles over time, let's throw some events at it. Let's throw the owner's retirement here in year 3. Let's throw the owner's death in year 1. Let's throw the child changing their mind about being in the company in year 4. How does this affect our timeline? And what begins to emerge is how you need to shore up the timeline in order to accommodate the most different scenarios for the future. So it becomes obvious that if a son or daughter does not have the skills they need, the company is not going to benefit under any scenario that's going to be going forth in the future. So it helps pave the way for that uncomfortable conversation that says, hey, you know, we need to have you either get out of the company and work somewhere else for a while, or go back and get your MBA, or figure out something else to do, which of course you wouldn't say it that way, but that's the gist of the conversation that needs to occur. And the best circumstance is where you can get the child to see it themselves, to see the writing on the wall, and then know that the best outcome for everybody is for them to pursue the necessary gap in their abilities.
I think that's brilliant, George. You've taken the names out of the planning up front. You've taken the personality conflicts of family relationships out of it and just said what's best for the business, and then reinsert those individuals back in and say, now what happens if your situation changes? I think that's brilliant. That's exactly what business owners should be, how they should approach this. How do our listeners get in touch with you to learn more about how you approach this, and where do they find you, George?
I'm based in the Research Triangle area of North Carolina. The website is www.strategicdevelopment.com, and they can reach me personally at 919-740-8407 or gsmart@strategicdevelopment.com.
And what will they find at your website?
They will find information on the two primary services we offer. For small business, family business, like we're discussing here, I work as a business coach, coming in and working with the owners, the management team. And then we also, for large corporations like Microsoft, Department of Transportation, things like that, we do leadership development simulations for leadership development programs inside companies.
Well, you've given us some very, very insightful information, George, but unfortunately we only scratched the surface today, so I hope that we can talk again in the near future and go deeper on this topic, because there's a lot more, I'm sure, that we can do to help our listeners get prepared for this. I hope they'll get in touch with you, and I look forward to the next time we speak.
Thank you very much, Bill. I appreciate it.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this, so please stay tuned. Does thinking about what will happen to your business if you're gone keep you awake at night? Will you get the price you need from your business to carry you through retirement? The BEI Network of Exit Planning Professionals is the world's leading advisor network with the power to help business owners transition out of business on their own timeline and terms. Ask your most trusted advisor to create a BEI plan for you, or visit us at exitplanning.com. That's exitplanning.com.
You're listening to ExitCoachRadio.com, the information station for age 50-plus business owners, where we're interviewing top advisors for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new one-minute tips every day. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio. Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Thanks so much, everyone, for being with us today. My next guest is Dr. Jerry Kornfeld. I'm excited to introduce him. Jerry runs something called Ask Dr. Jerry, and Ask Dr. Jerry presents longevity and health topics to Vistage Group's TV, cruise ships, boomers and seniors, and he has two hot topics we're going to talk about, living to 100 with quality. And Dr. Smartphone will see you now. So, Dr. Jerry, thanks very much for joining us, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited about being on.
Well, excited to have you. Tell us a little bit about
how you started Ask Dr. Jerry, and what is that all about?
Well, I've been in family practice in Southern California for many, many years, and during that period of time, I've had the opportunity to write a few books and do some television interviews. And during those television interviews, the questions kept on coming in from the staff, the crew, etc. And I kept on thinking, don't these folks have a doctor that can ask these questions of? And it turned out that there was just a great need for somebody to be available, not to practice medicine, not to diagnose or treat, but just to answer routine questions. You go to see a doctor, you come back, and your wife, your husband says, well, what did the doctor say? Well, you know, I forgot to ask him that. And so Ask Dr. Jerry started that way. And we had a television show here on our local television. We were with Regis Philbin when he first started his program in Southern California, AM Los Angeles, where we did all of those various segments. And we still routinely do them periodically at our local television station. Plus, I offer it to all of my audiences, the opportunity to not only ask me at the time I'm speaking, but to take my email address and I'm available to respond to them. Obviously not diagnosing and treating, but to routine questions. So that's the whole origin of why I am now Ask Dr. Jerry.
If you were to graph out what the most common questions you get, what would they be?
Well, it depends upon the age of the audience, obviously, and it depends upon the demographic and the sexuality. But particularly on cruise ships, most of my audiences are female, so-called insurance widows, and so they have questions. But obviously with the male audiences, heart disease is probably the most common thing because it is our number one, unfortunately, fatal disease. And so I wrote a book called Your 100-Year Heart, dedicated to the premise that our hearts are dying too young. I just got so frustrated seeing young men coming into the hospital with heart attacks when, in fact, heart disease, as my book clearly demonstrates, is in the majority of cases a preventable disease. And our lifestyle is the major contributor to why this is the number one fatal disease. And that statistic should be changed. It should not stand. And that was the motivation for writing the book. So that area is very, very common. People want to know about cholesterol and want to know about blood pressure and all those other factors. And, of course, with females, it's a little bit different. Even though heart disease is the number one killer of both men and women, with females, menopause at the boomer age also is a very common question.
So the fact that we just don't take responsibility for our lifestyles and how we care for our gift, you know, our gift of our bodies, it's our own fault?
Absolutely. Let me tell you, that got me into my new hot topic, which is living to 100 with quality. There's no question our lifestyle is the major factor in the majority of ailments that we have. And we used to think that our longevity was based 100% upon our genes. If we had family who lived to 80 or 90, the good chances we were. Well, that was true up until about a generation or so ago, and our lifestyle has so drastically changed because we spend most of our time sitting in front of our computer or in front of our television or sitting in our car. And what was true 100 years ago, when our body did most of the activities for us by walking or lifting or whatever, we have changed our lifestyle drastically. And so we now say that genes probably accounts for 20 or 30% of your longevity, but you can alter your genes. Genes are a DNA and a protein in a DNA, and you literally can alter your genes with your lifestyle. And we have significant evidence now, long studies to demonstrate that being valid.
So if you were to have that typical person who's asking about heart disease and say, you can start this today. Today is the first day of the rest of your life. If you're going to live to have a 100-year heart, here are the three top things you need to do. What would they be?
Well, I have a list of about 10 things, I say, pleasurable things that obviously one has to do. But if I was just to give you one or two, I would say right on top of the list is exercise. Absolutely no question, our lifestyle has to include exercise. Unfortunately, most of us, when we hear the word exercise, get turned off because we think of the negative aspects. Well, I don't have time to join a gym. Gyms are too expensive. It's just too. I'm not comfortable joining a gym. I can't become a marathon runner at my age. I mean, all those statements are just rationalizations. First of all, most important, get it straight. You don't have to join a gym. When I say exercise, all the studies from the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association, clearly indicate walking is the absolute best tool for exercise. A 30-minute walk a day, a minimum of 5 days a week, will satisfy the exercise criteria. Now, I'm not talking walking and strolling and looking at the stars. I'm talking about a brisk walk. And people say, what is a brisk walk? I say, well, have you ever been late for an appointment or late for work? Walk as if you're late for an appointment. That's a brisk walk. That is absolutely number one. Number two, the foods you put in your body. We, unfortunately, don't pay much attention to advice about food because we are so programmed to like things. I give the analogy that if you just got a brand new Ferrari and you paid $150,000 for it, and all of a sudden you have a pinging in your motor, and you go to the mechanic, and the mechanic says, well, you know, using that cheap gas, it's going to kill your motor. I guarantee you'll never again in your life put that gas in that car. But if you come to me with chest pain and I talk to you about your lifestyle and I talk to you about the foods you're putting in your body and I tell you not to do that, you leave my office and say, yeah, I got to cut that out. Until you go to the restaurant with your friends and you are having a couple of drinks and feeling good and forget about the food. You just never enjoy yourself. And so we ignore that advice. And that's number two. And number three, if I were to give you three, would be attitude. There's just no question, your attitude controls your destiny. Every time I've seen a patient who's had a problem, who does not do well, I think of other patients who had the same problem at the same age and treated with the same medication who did do well. And I look to see why. And guess what? The why is those who had a positive attitude, those who did not sit around all day complaining about their illness, always got better faster. So exercise, the foods you put in your body, and your attitude, I would give you a three.
Excellent, excellent. So let's talk about the patient-doctor relationship and how it's being changed by the smartphone and medical apps. Do you think that that's going to damage the relationship between patients and doctors, and why so?
There's absolutely no question in my mind that the patient-doctor relationship is an integral part of how you react and how you do. For many years, I'm a faculty member of the UCLA Medical School, and for many years, I taught freshman medical students a class called Doctoring, which we taught them the art of communicating with their patients, because we feel strongly if your patient likes you, if you have a good relationship with the other patient, they are going to do better. You may have had this experience or heard people say, you know what, I went to see this doctor, but I don't trust that guy. I don't think he knows what he's doing. You're not going to take the medicine, you're not going to follow his advice, and you're not going to do well. But if you like your doctor and have a relationship and feel comfortable with your doctor, you're absolutely going to do better. So doctor-patient relationships, to me, are an integral part of my specialty of family medicine, and I think of any relationship between a doctor. So it's going to have an effect. Right now, economics is a major factor in the practice of medicine. And doctors are being harassed to get patients in and out because of the cost. As a matter of fact, a word that was very common, or still very common, in the business world, productivity. I never thought I'd hear that word come into the medical world, but it is now in the medical world. Doctors are being penalized because they are not being productive enough. If a doctor, and this is a classic story. When I asked somebody when they first described to me productivity, I said, what do you mean? They said, so if a patient comes into your office and it's a revisit, in other words, you've seen them, they're coming back now for a checkup. And based upon the diagnosis, you'll be allowed a certain amount of time. So the patient's back for a revisit, and the diagnosis is whatever, you're allowed 5 minutes. And if you go 10 minutes, you're going to be penalized. And penalty means it'll come off of your income. If you go 3 minutes, you're going to be rewarded. Well, that's impossible. Somebody comes back into my office after I treated them. What happens if the medicine didn't work? What happens if they had a reaction to the medication? What happens if they develop another symptom? And all these things are intangibles. If it's black and white, they walk in and they're better, the medicine works, and they're cured, no problem. But that doesn't happen very often. So productivity and Dr. Smartphone, meaning Your smartphone now is right now in this whole world called telemedicine, diagnosing and treating on the computer. There is no hands-on by a doctor. You're at home, and it's interesting because I've done this talk to several distance groups, and I've got different reactions based upon the age of the group. Those, and it's not often that my business audience has CEOs who are in their 30s. I guess most of the CEOs are in their 50s. But in any event, I did this talk, and the group was very young CEOs. And when I got done with the talk, they thought there was nothing wrong with it. They loved the idea that they didn't have to leave their house. And many people listening to this may also say, yeah, that's great. I don't have to make an appointment for a doctor. I don't have to sit in the doctor's office for 2 hours. I don't have to go through a whole harassment. From my home, I can get treated. Well, that's good for about 80% of the illnesses that we have, because about 80% of the things that go into a doctor's office will get better generally, no matter what you do. So I always tell my audiences, anybody going to practice of medicine and have an 8 out of 10 track record that people are going to get better is pretty good. But you go to medical school, and I tell this to my students, you go to medical school to diagnose and treat the 20% who have significant illnesses that need your skills. And so that what's going to happen to the 20% when the computer hears your symptoms and it's going to go through a list of differential diagnoses, which is what I, as a trained physician, did in my brain. My computer, my brain, made the differential diagnosis. But the computer is going to do it. It's going to come up with a list of potential diagnoses based upon your symptoms. And then based upon that list, tests may be ordered. And based upon the results of those tests, medicine will be prescribed. And if you do get to talk to somebody about what's going on, it may not be a physician. And that's what's going on today. And so I am very concerned, even though many people in the audience may not be, and I've heard this argument, well, I know, I think it's good that the computer probably knows more than the doctor. And so there's a big, big battle going on. And I think what has been traditional for the practice of medicine for centuries is going to be eliminated. And I'm very unhappy about that.
So it just ruins that whole, the potential for misdiagnosis is great at that point where it might matter the most, because, like you said, 8 out of 10 of them are going to say, take 2 Tylenol and visit me back
exactly.
in the morning, you know, no problem. But it's that
exactly.
2 out of 10 that really could be life-changing, and they're not going to get that kind of, the potential for mistakes is there. 2 out of 10 is really, you know, 200,000 out of a million over a course of a short period of time, I'm sure.
But it's your life. It's 100%, and that's the thing. That's why, as I said, that's why we go to medical school, to be able to diagnose those other illnesses. Majority of people who come into my office or any doctor's office in primary care are there with thought-related illnesses: backaches, headaches, stomach aches, skin rashes, blood pressure problems. I mean, a lot of these things are not very complicated, and you don't have to go through 8 to 10 years of formal medical education to deal with them. The whole concept really developed from the military with the medic, and that's a very valuable concept because there's a need for the medic in the military. And the medics, and I was a medic before I went to medical school, so I know that experience. Medics take care of a lot of people, but most of the stuff they take care of is routine. And so nobody's thinking about the 20%. They're thinking about routine. That you really, I mean, I could take anybody and give them 6 months of training, and they can go into an office and take care of most of the people that come in, but not the 20%.
Yeah, what if they hear something? You know, not everybody is perfect with their recollection of symptoms as well, and so a good doctor can figure out, hey, you know, something else is not right here. You know, there's something about that. So from a doctor's perspective, if these things are taking away that 80%, isn't some of that, I mean, does, as a family practitioner or a GP, for instance, doesn't that impact your income if patient flow is diminished to a small, is it worth it to be a doctor,
I guess,
at that point?
Okay, what's happening, as I said, the economics, what's happening is that many doctors are hiring non-doctors, because economically it's much less expensive to hire a physician's assistant as opposed to hiring an MD. A physician's assistant may hire it in at $80,000 a year. an MD obviously would be higher than that. So the laws have specifically identified how many physician's assistants a doctor can have in his office, and he allegedly is supposed to supervise them. But now the laws are changing, and they're allowing a lot of non-physicians to practice without a physician supervising them. And so if a physician hires three or four physician's assistants, paying them less and seeing those patients, what's going to happen is income is going to go up because they have that much more volume because they've got that many more people seeing patients. So the economics from the perspective of cutting down on the physicians and increasing that can have an economic positive effect in a busy physician's office.
Okay, well, let's turn the page on that and talk about living to 100, because that's your book is your 100-year heart. And
right.
What makes you think that living to 100 is on the horizon?
We are right now. I'm glad you asked me that question, because I think this topic is unbelievable. The opportunity that we are experiencing, most people just don't realize. And I'm doing that right now. I'm on the lecture circuit right now, speaking to boomer and senior groups wherever I can to tell them that our culture has taught us that when we reach our 65th birthday, that it's time to sit in a chair and stop. I cannot tell you how many years I've heard patients say, well, I can hardly wait 5 years, I can retire. I mean, that's so sad. They spent their lives waiting to retire. The whole concept of aging is going to a major, major change, because in the past 100 years, we have almost doubled our lifespan. And people don't think about that. So if we have doubled our lifespan, almost doubled our lifespan in the past 100 years, we went from about 40-something up to late 70s. If you think about what the potential is, why cannot we live to 100 or 150? As a result, many major medical centers around the world, and Cambridge in England is one of the primary ones, have developed programs. And they have a very interesting opening line in their program. And I use this in all of my talks because it stimulates a reaction. And your reaction will be interesting also. The opening line is, the first person to live to 1,000 was just born. Now, how do you react
wow.
to that?
Wow.
How do you
to
react
1,
to that?
To 1,000. Wow.
Yeah, to 1,000 was just born.
With disbelief, I guess, incredible disbelief. A hundred seemed like a long time, but 1,000? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, well, everybody said, yeah, it's impossible. It never happened. I said, how do you know what happened? Why is it that we have accepted, and this is what the researchers are looking into, why is it that we have accepted that death is inevitable? You know, death and taxes are inevitable. There are animals that don't die. Salamanders can regenerate all of their body parts and tissues. Why? And DNA, by the way, of all living things, plants, animals, humans, is 99% the same. The 1% difference in the DNA is what separates us from each other species. So why cannot man do that? And that's what they're looking at. And to make it more exciting, and the reason I'm so excited about this is because Silicon Valley billionaires, you know, the young guys who have sold their tech companies for hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, well, a significant percentage of them, many of the real big names, are putting hundreds of millions of dollars into this whole project of increasing lifespan. And they're looking at the relationship that our cells have and why do the cells die. And they're coming up with some fantastically exciting things. Obviously, the motivation is not to die. And they're saying, why do we have to die? And nobody ever really asked that question until all this money started pouring into it. So the reason I'm so excited about it now is that there literally are billions of dollars coming from these Silicon Valley billionaires into this whole world of extending lifespan. And there's some interesting things I can tell you about that they're finding out. How does that sound to you?
Well, we can certainly, you know, when I think about it, I think we can certainly eradicate disease. We can take away, and we have taken away, many of the things that would normally have done us in early. Economically, it's a tough one because we're set up for people to kind of
stop being productive and earning income at a certain age. That, and again, it's our mindset. You're right. It was age 65 was Otto von Bismarck in the, you know, the Prussian who set 65 as the normal retirement age back when life expectancy was mid 40s, you know, 50 years old, many years ago. So it's a mindset. It's a mindset, and it would require a lot of retooling. But I guess, you know, physically, what is a 200-year-old person? We see 100-year-old people under the circumstances they've lived through. What will they look like, do you think? I mean,
those are all very interesting questions.
Let me give you one more viewpoint. I tell people today, 65 is the new 55. We've all heard that. 75 is the new 65, but 80 still looks like 80.
No, 80 is the new 60. Okay. You've got to start thinking about the brain and the body, and the brain controls the body. Your thoughts, your attitude become negative when you start reaching the elderly age. And we still refer to 55 as the beginning of elderly, by the way, which is absurd. But the physical appearances, the cell deterioration, a significant amount of that is coming because of your behavior and your attitude. Woe is me. It's all over. I don't have anything to look forward to. I'm going to stop. And how often, I don't know if you ever heard this, but how often the statement has been made by kids to their parents, "Hey, Dad, you know, at your age, you really shouldn't be doing that."
Yeah.
That's nonsense. I tell people, never let the two numbers after your name control your destiny. Your physical and mental condition, but the two numbers are irrelevant. And I show pictures of people in their 70s, 80s, 90s, 100s, winning marathons, winning medals, breaking new world's records. I've got a lady who's 86 who is a gymnast. I've got a gentleman who's 101 who rides bicycles for France and just won a big race. This is all over the place. Those are the people who have not accepted the numbers as the end of their lifestyle. If you accept them, your cells are going to deteriorate. Let me just throw in one other thing, because this is really one of the exciting pieces of research. Something called telomeres. Have you ever heard that word?
No,
telomeres.
I haven't.
Telomeres. Okay. Well, not many people have. And it's come because of this research. It turns out, on the tip of our chromosomes, you know, we have 23 pair of chromosomes, which because of the technology we've identified, and each one of those chromosomes on their tip have this cap. And I describe the cap as if on your shoelaces, on your tennis shoes, you have this white plastic tip, that cap.
Uh-huh.
Well, on the tip of your chromosomes, you know, the chromosomes, the X and the Y, the male and female, those chromosomes have your DNA and they control your destiny. Well, it turns out those chromosomes with their telomeres are the key factors. They have done the research to identify that the length of the telomere, and you can, this is all documented, you could look all this up, the length of the telomeres controls the longevity of the cell. And as the cells start to age, the telomeres are shortening. So shortening of telomeres are related to aging and death of a cell. And they have done some fantastic research at the University of California in San Francisco, looking at those who have a positive lifestyle, who live longer, and have been able to evaluate length of telomeres, and lifestyle literally prevents telomeres from shrinking. That is fantastic.
Wow.
You know, I say to
that
people,
that is fantastic.
Yeah, that's the kind of research that's going on. Looking how to keep your telomeres longer. It's not yet something that you go to your doctor's office and get your telomeres measured. It's all the research environment. But that research. So if you look up telomeres, TERS, it's unbelievable what's going on because of all this billions of dollars coming into this area.
Well, Dr. Jerry, it's a fantastic information, very, very enlightening. We're out of time today, but I want to have you back and talk more about this because it is fantastic and very interesting. Tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, though, and let's close with that.
Okay. My email address is KJBK, K is in Kornfeld, K, KJBKORN, KJB Korn at AOL. and I'm certainly available to answer questions at all times. My website's in the process of being redone, but it's Ask Doctor, spell out Doctor, D-O-C-T-O-R, Ask Dr. Jerry. My profile is on LinkedIn and all the other places when you Google my name.
And again, Dr. Jerry's book is Your 100-Year Heart, and he is certainly available if you're a Vistage chairperson or another business group leader. Give him a call. He's obviously a fascinating speaker, someone that you'd want to have talk to your group. So, Dr. Jerry, thank you so much for joining us. Very fascinating, and I look forward to the next time we talk.
Thank you. The book's on Google also, by the way, and Amazon. The book's on Amazon also.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to it next time.
Thank you. Bye.
We're going to call it a day for our show today. Thank you very much for joining us. Tomorrow, join us again. We have a three-hour show planned with 9 professional advisors, authors, and thought leaders. We're here for you, our private business owners, so that you can be well-planned. Please join us again sometime soon. Thank you.
You're listening to ExitCoachRadio.com, the information station for age 50-plus business owners, where we're interviewing top advisors for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new one-minute tips every day. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.